it's something that I think all genres of classical music especially are really having to think about right now. How do we make this accessible to everyone, not just financially, but also in the manner and the approach?
I'm Joni Deutsch, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Amplifier, the music podcast where we shine a light on the artist who calls Charlotte home. Because Charlotte is more than just a banking city or a football city. So every other Thursday on this podcast, we're going to explore the people, places, and things that helped define the Queen City's crown sound. And today, we'll hear from a North Carolina opera singer who isn't afraid to belt it out. That's coming up on Amplifier.
Amplifier.
And then the beat will drop.
Amplifier.
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 Amplifier. Can you introduce yourself and what you do?
Hi, my name is Melinda Whittington, and I'm a professional opera singer.
And you're so excited about it.
I am. You know, for a long time, I called myself a lot of different things. And, you know, I'm a singer, I'm a voice teacher. I do a million things to make ends meet. But it's only been in the past, I'd say, 4 or 5 years that I make the majority of my living performing opera. And it feels really good to be able to say, that's my job. I'm an opera singer.
How did you get started in music?
I grew up so far away from classical music and opera. My dad was a minister, and my mom was the leader of the band and the choir, and so music was always in the house. We had a drum set and electric basses and guitars and a Hammond B3 organ in our basement growing up. So I played a lot of those more, like, I guess you'd say contemporary instruments. The style of music at the church was very contemporary, a lot of gospel, a lot of praise and worship. And so I just grew up singing in church, playing my guitar, singing praise and worship songs, and wishing I could write songs. I tried, but I was always really bad at it. And I was always a person who wanted to get it right, and I made good grades, and I studied hard. So I went to college knowing I wanted to study music, but I didn't really know what that meant. I didn't know that as a voice major, I'd be taking voice lessons where I had to learn to sing in Italian and learn about the history of, you know, Mozart concertos and memorize all of Beethoven's sonatas. Like, it didn't occur to me at the time, but as I started studying, it really grew on me because it appealed to that kind of nerdy side of me. I combined my love for history and languages and cultures and studying, and it combined that with taking on a character, which I always love to do on stage, and singing. So I just kind of stumbled into it, to tell you the truth.
That was Melinda Whittington performing Chanson Triste by Henri Dupac. Did you always have the desire to work in opera, though? At what point did you realize that's what I wanted to do as an artist?
Well, that's a good question. So I did a lot of plays and musicals growing up, and I always loved, like I said, taking on a character. I did a few opera scenes in college, and at first it was weird singing in different languages, but then I would say probably around my senior year in college, I thought, man, this is really the perfect combination of everything I love. Let me learn a little more about it. I'd been to maybe 2 operas in my whole life at that point. And my university, I went to UNC Chapel Hill, and they offer a scholarship called the Phillips, where you can apply for up to, I think it was $7,000 to carry out an idea that didn't have to be academic, it could be experiential. You know, I want to bike the Andes or I, you know, whatever. And so I said, I want to go to Germany and Austria and see opera for 3 months. It was Mozart's 250th birthday. And there were so many festivals going on. And I got the scholarship. They loved it. I went, I probably saw 45 operas, went to every museum, went to every concert I could cram in, and just me and my backpack. And after that, I said, all right, I think this is what I want to do.
That's Melinda Whittington performing Il bel sonno di Dorita by Giacomo Puccini. For some artists that are like the singer-songwriter types or the rockers or pop musicians, anyone, they typically start off by making their music, going to open mic nights, going to the kind of local venues, building up the reputation, word of mouth, maybe getting to the point where they have an agent or a record label. I'm wondering what that process is like starting out in an opera and how you went from point A starting out to where you are now.
So coming off of college, I spent a few years just seeing if I could make a living as a musician, whatever that meant. So it meant leading group musical theater classes for kids at an arts conservatory and being a section leader in a choir at a church and singing for local funerals and weddings and auditioning like crazy. So in the opera world, basically, at least in America, you get hired on a gig-by-gig basis. So in Germany, you have what's called a Fest system, where one company would hire you to sing for the whole season, and you do a lot of different roles there, and you maybe even have something like health insurance. So here in America, it's more of the gig economy in the opera world. So the way that a lot of young singers get started is what we call young artist programs. A lot of opera companies will have their own young artist program, and a lot of them are sort of freestanding or operate separately from an opera company. So the ones that work with the opera company, typically they get paid sort of a monthly stipend. They understudy the big roles. They sing small roles. They get lessons and coachings. They're doing a lot of outreach for the company, little, operas for kids or concerts for donors. And this is a really good way to kind of get your foot in the door. So they're very competitive. So I was auditioning at that time out of college. I was auditioning a lot for these young artist programs. And with any auditions, usually it feels like a 99% rejection. And so I kept putting one foot in front of the other, I guess. And lucky enough to make ends meet as a musician in the meantime, locally. I did Brevard Music Center here in North Carolina, which is a great training program, and I really got to actually do some roles. So I think the hard thing for young opera singers is the only way to get better at being an opera singer is to sing opera, and if nobody's giving you the opportunity to get your feet on the stage with an orchestra in the pit and really sing one of these huge, demanding roles that the greats for hundreds of years have sung, if you never get a chance to do it, it's really hard to get better at it. And so Brevard Music Center was the place that gave me a chance to sing three really big roles, Rosalind in Die Fledermaus, Alcina in Alcina by Handel, and Violetta in La Traviata by Verdi. And after that, I went from auditioning for years and years and getting nothing and doing a training program to suddenly getting into the Young Artist Program at San Francisco Opera. And that was a biggie. And after that, doors kind of started opening. So started with the San Francisco program. Then I got into the Academy of Vocal Arts, which is a very prestigious training program in Philadelphia. The summer before I went to Philadelphia, I made it into the Metropolitan Opera National Council auditions. I was a semifinalist, and I got to go to the Met and sing two arias on the stage. A lot of people in the industry come to both the semifinals and the finals, so that was another chance for exposure. But I would say it was about a five-year period of like, okay, I'm doing all the right things. Like, I'm singing at all the big young artist programs. I'm doing the Met competition. I'm at ABA. I still wasn't getting an agent. It still took like beating down the doors, basically.
The little dropping of in, like, yeah, I got to perform on the main stage of the Met is a huge deal. And I kind of want to get into that for a second, if you can explain like why that is such a big deal to be able to be on that stage.
Sure. I mean, what I felt in the moment, why it was a big deal to me was sort of the history, the legends that had stood, as I imagined, in very romantically in my head, that had stood in that very same spot, you know? Even the greats who had stood in that spot and sang the aria that I was singing. And the Met, at least in America, oh, everywhere, but especially in America, represents kind of like the top of the top, you know? Of course, they have a humongous budget. They draw the best singers. So to get the chance, you know, I wasn't hired by the Met. I wasn't singing a role with the Met. You know, hopefully that will come one day. But just to get a chance to stand on that stage was pretty magical. I'd been to so many performances at the Met. It's making me smile just to sit here and think about it.
I was going to say that, like, your face is just glowing right now because you're just thinking about performing there.
And I just think about, man, I want to do it again.
What can help you get back to that point where you would get back on stage? Like, what are the things that you have in motion right now that can...
To get back on the Met stage?
Yeah.
Really, honestly, so... And everybody's process is a little different. But for me, because I sing kind of what we call the big girl roles, usually the title role, it's one of those things, like, a company like the Met is not going to hire someone like me to do a role that I haven't done a million times at smaller regional houses, if that makes sense. Usually. You know, occasionally you get that star who just, like, breaks through the top and they make their Met debut really young. But actually, for me and who I am as a person, I like that better. I like the sort of slow, steady build. I want the chance to get, you know, for example, I'm singing Tatiana in Eugene Onegin here this coming season with Opera Carolina. And I had studied it before. I understudied a superstar in Chicago at Chicago Lyric. And so I got more chance to study it there. Now I'm performing it here, and probably I'll perform it a few other times with companies, regional companies like Opera Carolina. And then maybe one day I'll sing it at the Met. I don't know. Honestly, the best thing I can do is to keep focusing on honing my skill. For me, my definition of success was never, I'm going to sing at the Met, or I want to sing at all the big European houses. My definition of success was, if I'm making good art and I'm surrounded by people who are also making good art, like, that's awesome, first of all. Then, if you're going to pay me to do that, great. If you're going to pay me enough to pay my bills, you know, to make a decent living, I'm not asking to be a millionaire, but if my job is to make good art with other people who are passionate about making good art, I'm happy. I don't care if that's happening in Charlotte or Birmingham, Alabama, or New York or Vienna. You know what I mean?
You mentioned the superstar status. And I just wonder, like, could you dissect that? What makes a superstar in the world of opera?
That's a great question. I mean, of course, my brain at first goes to, like, the money. How much these people get paid. But no, what makes a superstar is someone who has spent a lot of time building a reputation. A reputation that of consistency, They deliver, and they deliver something special. You know, it's the same. It's the same again as in the rock world or any artistic genre. When especially when you're repeating the same music, so you're not. My opportunity to be creative is not to sit down and write a new. So like I have to take a song that other people have sung hundreds of times and make it fresh, right? So I think people who achieve that superstar status are people who bring something really special to the table in how in terms of how they interpret that role dramatically or vocally or both. Both is the real package, right? But we have singers like, I mean, Maria Callas had a great instrument, but even when she didn't sing pretty, right, or she made sounds that were just sort of on the edge of what's considered beautiful, she was so compelling dramatically, and we remember her for that. So it's just bringing your own individuality to something that has been done a million times.
That's Melinda Whittington performing The Song to the Moon by Antonin Dvorak. Coming up, Melinda Whittington and what it takes to bring opera to the masses. That's right after this break on Amplifier. Hey, Amplifier listeners. Since we started this podcast in September, we've heard from so many fans and music friends who've discovered a new sound from the series. And one of my favorite comments recently came from social media fan Spumanticarlo. I hope I pronounced that correctly. He had this cool story to share. I've been in the area for 20 years, and I thought I had a good idea of what the Charlotte music scene was like. Your podcast has completely changed that idea. I went to my first Loft Session show because of Amplifier and hearing Emily Sage's interview. I appreciate what you are doing for the city and its music scene. So yeah, talk about a sweet comment, right? If you're like that listener and you have a story to share about how you listen to this podcast or who you've enjoyed discovering along the way, let me know and I'll share it on an upcoming episode. You can tag me on social media at A Change of Tune, or you can leave a rating review on Apple Podcasts. Of course, you can find all the information on our website at wfae.org/amplifier. While you do that, let's get back to our interview. You've played a number of roles over the years. I mean, looking at the number of productions you've been in, Romeo and Juliet, Don Giovanni, Carmen, and you're returning to the role of the Contessa in La Nozze di Figaro in the 2017-18 season of North Carolina Opera. Do you happen to have a favorite character that you've played or one that you could just continue playing for the years to come because you love it so much?
I definitely have a handful of those that I'm building, which is really nice. But I will single out one that you didn't mention that's a kind of a little bit off the beaten path. And that's the role of Marie Antoinette in The Ghosts of Versailles by an amazing living composer, John Corigliano. And people may know him, if they know him, they would probably, you know, in popular context, know him from his score for the movie The Red Violin. But he wrote this opera that is just so brilliant and was such a good fit for me vocally. I sang this opera at Wolf Trap one season as a young artist in DC. I'm waiting for the next opportunity to sing it. It doesn't come along like A Marriage of Figaro, like a Bohème as often, but I hope I get to do it again.
What's the process behind getting into a role? Maybe I'm just dumb to say like this, but you go through auditions, you get cast. What are the next steps after getting podcasts where you do the preparation work that you're referring to?
So with opera companies, you're expected to show up first day of rehearsals, completely learned and memorized. You're going to start the rehearsal process and have probably anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks of rehearsal before you go into the performances. So what's most important that you get done on your own before that time is learning the music and memorizing the music, learning the language, memorizing the language. When you get there, you're going to have a director, a stage director, in addition to a conductor, who's going to help kind of walk you through the process of dramatically taking on that character. Of course, it's important to come with some ideas. What I like to do is I like to read any source material that there is. So you mentioned Le Nozze di Figaro. There's so much to read there. Of course, you want to read the original play, the Beaumarchais play. I like to read the play. I like to study and see which portions of the play the librettist took maybe exactly word for word and put in the opera, which scenes were cut, which scenes were included, why. Can I draw from the scenes in the play or the book that weren't included? Do they fill in some gaps in my character story from the opera? There's no way, because opera is such a stretched out experience of time, there's no way to put every detail from a book or a play in an opera. It would take 8 hours to perform or more. and they're long enough, right? I'd read the source material and I study the language, just speaking the language and reading the libretto, meaning just the text, before I even bring the music to it. I might listen to a few different performances of it by singers that I like or even singers that I don't like. I listen to things that are just a variety of different things to see how people have interpreted it over the years. So that's the process. And then over the course of the months leading up to the gig, I could feel like I could run the whole opera from memory. I'm ready to go. I show up and I'm ready to do the character work, which I've put some thought into as well on my own.
So at this point, are you basically fluent in like 5 different languages?
I wish I was. It's a lifetime study, which is another thing that really appealed to me about it. But it's weird because I can say things like, you know, your destiny is united with mine, or, you know, in a language. But I can't say, like, where's the bathroom? Or, you know, I learned a completely different way of speaking that's very dramatic, very operatic. So I know some weird words. I know words in Czech, Russian, German, Italian, French, Spanish that the average person would never think, like, oh, I need to learn that word before I go to Germany, right? It's almost like a separate skill. The more fluent and conversational I become, the more I understand the grammar and the vocabulary of a language, of course, the better it's going to make my singing in that language. So I'm working towards that with French, German, Italian, Spanish.
On the note of languages, you know, when it comes to classical music, and I would say also for opera, there's this idea of accessibility mm-hmm. for the public and making them feel like, even though this is, you know, fine art or high art or whatever you want to call it, that you can still understand the themes and the emotions underneath, and you don't have to be a certain economic level to enjoy it or socioeconomic level to enjoy it, but mm-hmm. you can be there and enjoy the art. So I wonder what your thoughts are. I mean, as you've been in this profession for a while now, what are your thoughts on that?
It's your question gets to the heart of something that I think all genres of classical music especially are really having to think about right now. How do we make this accessible to everyone, not just financially, but also in the manner and the approach artistically? There are so many companies that are popping up doing really interesting things, you know, doing operas in on-site locations that fit the story really well. And you're not going to have a big pit, and tickets aren't going to cost as much, and you can drink your beer, and, you know, you can come casually. Those things, I think, are doing a lot to revitalize opera for a modern audience, especially a modern American audience. There are also a lot of great composers who are writing operas, writing music that needs to be heard. And these smaller companies are giving opportunities for that. And companies, even bigger companies are, of course, too. Like we're doing, we just did the, here in Charlotte, I Dream by Tappan. And it was fantastic. I mean, if you missed it, you really missed something special. It was really spectacular. So there's a lot of new music going on. There's a lot of music in interesting places going on. And arts organizations are having to figure out that balance right now. They also, you know, let's be honest about it. Opera and symphonic music, it's very expensive to do. You have so many parts. As opera singers, when we get to the stage where we incorporate the orchestra, nothing else matters. Every second of time that the orchestra is on the clock is hundreds and hundreds of dollars. And so, you know, if you can't be late to an orchestra rehearsal. We can't stop and focus on something with the costuming or the drama when the orchestra's there. So just by the sheer numbers of people involved, you know, putting on an opera is very expensive if done traditionally.
I've been seeing more so maybe with symphonies than I have with operas in recent years, where they are reducing the ticket prices. They're allowing for social media to be used in the concerts and performances. They're doing outreach activities in the community where, like you were referring to earlier, they'll go and they'll grab beers at the brewery while you can listen to the music, which typically are in concert halls.
Right.
And it's been nice to see that, because you are encouraging a different demographic to come in and enjoy the same art that anyone should be enjoying.
Right. And I don't think it's watering it down. I think it's important to have both. And hopefully, so what's kind of different about our generation is, like, there's not always the carryover. So, you know, the symphony goes to the brewery, but do the people from the brewery go to the symphony? You know, do they say, hey, that was awesome, I want to support my local symphony? And, you know, like I said, it takes both sides. So the arts organizations have to figure out a way to make it more accessible financially to younger audience, while also making, you know, getting in, not being in the red the whole season. So I don't think it's a question or a dilemma with an easy answer. But I personally, I love it. I'm all about finding any way to make opera or classical music more accessible to people. If that means performing an opera in English, even, that's very, you know, some people have very strong opinions about that.
Really?
You know, to take something out of its original language, you certainly lose from if you're going to be, like you said earlier, highbrow about it, you lose a lot of the particular color and context of that language and that culture. And it's very hard to make the music that was written for that language make sense in another. But you're creating an opportunity for someone to find a window into a world that they otherwise would not have had. So I think we need to make adjustments for the modern world. And I think the modern world would greatly benefit from coming to more traditional operatic and symphonic concerts.
Summertime and the living is easy. Fish are jumping and the cotton is high. Oh, your daddy's rich and your ma is good looking. But hush, little baby, don't you cry.
Melinda Whittington is based in Charlotte and performs both locally and nationally. Find her tour schedule on melindawhittington.com. Amplifier is a production of WFAE. This episode was written and produced by me, Joni Deutsch.
Our associate producer is Cole Del Charco. Our editors are Greg Collard and Jadon Marshall. Our theme music is provided by Dirty Art Club. Share your favorite Charlotte music recommendations with me on social media. You can tag and follow me. I'm at A Change of Tune. Amplifier features a new musical episode every other Thursday. So make sure to subscribe to the Amplifier podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you find podcasts. And if you're listening on NPR One, make sure to give us a heart or a favorite. Check out the playlist and show notes for today's episode, along with a Charlotte music map and a way for you to submit your music on our website, wfae.org/amplifier. Until next time, I'm Joni Deutsch. Thanks for listening.
Movie? That was awesome.
I don't know.
That was awesome.